Today in the last case in our January assignment, 98-1105CR, State v. Magnuson. Ms. Herman, Assistant Attorney General, arguing for the State of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Laura Herman, representing the State of Wisconsin, the petitioner in this matter. There are two central questions in this case. First, what is the definition of custody for purposes of the sentence credit statute? And second, was Mr. Magnuson in custody during the 6 months he resided with Pastor Clark pursuant to his release on a signature bond? We ask this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and hold that custody for purposes of sentence credit is defined according to the escape statute definition of custody, and hold that Mr. Magnuson was not in custody under that definition. Alternatively, if this court nonetheless retains the unworkable Colette standard, we ask that this court impose some parameters to make that standard more workable. Before I get into the heart of my argument, I would like to start by pointing out that electronic monitoring is a red herring in determining whether a defendant is in custody for purposes of sentence credit. In this case, the Court of Appeals placed particular emphasis on electronic monitoring in reaching the conclusion that Mr. Magnuson was in custody. But electronic monitoring is really irrelevant to the question of custody for purposes of sentence credit, because electronic monitoring is really that, a monitoring device. It does not physically detain or restrain a defendant. It merely monitors compliance with the requirement that a person be in a particular place at a particular time. A defendant subject to electronic monitoring can physically move about the residence or the place where he is supposed to be. In this case, like Mr. Magnuson, if someone is supposed to be detained to their home subject to electronic monitoring, that person can still move about their residence. They can, in fact, physically leave the residence if they so choose.
Yeah, but somebody can escape from prison, too, if they so choose.
True, but it's a little more difficult.
A little more difficult, but you still would say if they're in prison or in jail, they get credit for it.
Right. If they are in jail, they are within the confines of an institution or a prison, and so therefore they are in the actual custody of an institution and would be entitled to sentence credit. My point with electronic monitoring is if we have two defendants, defendant X and defendant Y, both of whom are subject to home detention with exactly the same restrictions placed on them. Assuming both of them comply with the restrictions that are placed on them, electronic monitoring makes absolutely no difference. If one of them is subject to electronic monitoring, it makes no difference to the question of custody. The restrictions are still exactly the same. The only difference electronic...
Would we have to overrule Colette if we take that position?
Yes, I believe that you would.
Yeah, because that was an intensive sanction case of electronic monitoring, right?
Right.
And the court there held that it was a functional equivalent.
Right.
You'd have to overrule.
Right.
You don't like Colette, not only for its result, but its, quote, new standard. Is that right?
Exactly.
So you want us to overrule Colette on both grounds.
Right.
Sorry,
on both what?
Grounds. That is the theory of what is custody.
Right.
And the holding in the case, the DIS. Well, can't you distinguish it because he wasn't under the Department of Intensive Sanction?
In Colette, the defendant was under
right.
Intensive
Sanction.
Right.
So can't you distinguish this from Colette?
That's a possibility to try and limit Colette purely to a situation of intensive sanctions, but it's still not a workable standard. We have the same problems with it, whether it applies only in limited circumstances or not. The problem with the Colette standard is that it's undesirable and unworkable because it leads to inconsistent results. It requires a trial court at the end of the sentencing hearing, where finally the question of sentence credit comes up, to try and figure out now exactly what were the restrictions or conditions placed on this person, And in fact, it may require the testimony from someone from intensive sanctions or from bail monitoring program. We may need to bring in all these people to testify about all the conditions.
It's really a short-lived issue made of that there's no intensive sanctions anymore, but you still have electronic monitoring. Is that possible?
It's my understanding.
December 31, 1999.
It's my understanding that under Truth in Sentencing, intensive sanctions still exist, but in a lesser capacity. Under Truth in Sentencing, my understanding is that during the period of confinement, we now have a sentence which includes a period of confinement and a period of extended supervision. My understanding is that Truth in Sentencing makes it so that a sentencing judge can no longer place a person in intensive sanctions during that first part, that confinement period. But intensive sanctions is still an available option during extended supervision or as an alternative to probation, parole, revocation, or extended.
But this was a bail situation, wasn't it?
This case was pretrial release on bond.
So can you still have electronic monitoring at that time?
Sure,
under the news, Truth in Sentencing?
Sure, I don't think anything about Truth in Sentencing alters the court being able to impose conditions of bond consistent with Chapter 969. So I don't think that changes.
Counsel, rather than a little ruling, Colette, how about if we blend it? Let me try this. Defining custody in a little bit broader way than it's defined just in the escape statute, but defining it in a way that if anyone is placed where they where leaving therefrom would subject them to an escape charge. But that would be custody. Then it's my understanding that absconding from DIS would subject them to an escape charge.
Right, I think that's true.
Uh-huh. So that you would say that any kind of placement that subjects the defendant to an escape charge would qualify for credit. What's wrong with that?
Well, the problem with that is I think it goes against the intent of the legislature. While we don't have a definition of custody neatly placed in the sentence credit statute, what we do have is some legislative history that strongly suggests that custody under the sentence credit statute was meant to be limited to actual confinement in a prison or jail. And that is based on the fact that our sentence credit statute was modeled after the federal sentence credit statute that was in place at the time. That federal statute has now changed. But if you look to this court's decision in Betcher, there's a discussion about where our sentence credit statute came from. And this court in that case acknowledged that it is based on the federal sentence credit statute. And so case law under that federal sentence credit statute is persuasive. And the language of that federal statute as it existed at the time our statute was adopted is strikingly similar to the language that our legislature chose. And case law under that federal sentence credit statute is very limited in its definition of custody. It says that custody means actual custodial incarceration in a jail or prison, not merely severe restraint on individual liberty. And in fact, these cases go so far as to say in the pretrial release on bail or bond context, custody does not include the time a defendant is released on bond, regardless of the conditions and restraints imposed. Given that Wisconsin's statute was modeled on this federal sentence credit statute and worded almost exactly the same, I think this case law under the federal statute sheds light on what the legislature intended in Wisconsin, that custody is limited to actual confinement in a jail or a prison, and that would suggest that release on bail or bond, assuming you're released from the jail, you can never really be in custody for purposes of sentence credit.
Why don't we just say that then, rather than tie it to the escape statute definition?
Well, the reason we're tying it to the escape statute definition is because it's something neat and workable to point to, and the definition I've just explained that stems from the federal statute, I think, largely resembles what Wisconsin's escape statute sets out, that is actual confinement in an institution.
Except with the case law and the Division of Intensive Sanctions context, et cetera, that's been altered, or the escape statute has been applied to situations that aren't an actual correctional facility, a prison or a jail, right?
I don't think that's
from the Division
true.
Of Intensive Sanctions.
Well, I think the difference there, the distinction that can be made, is intensive sanctions is defined in the statutes as a prison and as an institution.
But that's not for escape statute purposes, is it? That's for purposes of truncating the due process in order to effectuate the sanctions in a way that's constitutional, right?
That may be. I don't know exactly. I did search the legislative history of intensive sanctions to figure out why, given the varying restrictions in that program, it's defined as an institution or a prison. And I didn't find anything that really explained that, but I've forgotten what your original question was.
Well, it may have been for both reasons. We don't know, apparently, is what you're saying, because
right.
there wasn't anything in legislative history that says why.
Right. But I think even an argument could be made that intensive sanctions still falls within this definition of the escape statute. But the court doesn't need to go that far in this case because this is not an intensive sanctions case. Mr. Magnuson was not on intensive sanctions. There's no dispute about that. And
well, he could argue by analogy, and anybody on home detention with an electronic bracelet can argue by analogy that it's the same as the Division of Intensive Sanctions, which was, I mean, that's basically what DIS was. It's home detention on an electronic bracelet. There were some intermediate steps to get there from prison, but that's essentially what it is.
It's still different, though. Our position is that release on bond serves entirely different purposes, and a person is in an entirely different legal status than someone who winds up in intensive sanctions. It may look like someone that has the same conditions, whether they're released on bond or whether they're in intensive sanctions. But when you're released on bond, it's pre-trial, pre-conviction, pre-sentence. You haven't been adjudicated guilty. It's an entirely different status then, and it serves an entirely different purpose. The purpose of being released on bond under certain conditions is to assure the defendant's appearance at trial. When someone is placed in intensive sanctions or some other form of home detention, post-conviction and post-sentencing, or as a sentencing option, the person is in a different legal status. They are convicted. They are being sentenced.
That's true when he's in jail awaiting trial. He's kept there to make sure he'll be there. And yet you would give him credit for that. I mean, whether he's in jail at the beginning or the end, he's still in jail. Still confined.
Right, but federal courts that have looked at this distinction have said that there is a difference between home detention that is pursuant to bail or bond as opposed to post-sentencing or post-conviction, that there is a difference. There's a different legal status, and the purposes and policies behind the program that the person is in and the timing of it do make a difference. But I would go back to the point that this is not an intensive sanctions case, and this court doesn't need to go there.
Let me interrupt you for just a minute. My understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the people that were actually doing the monitoring on the bracelet program were intensive sanctions employees.
Right.
Is that significant in this case?
It's not significant. There's no question that Mr. Magnuson was not actually placed in intensive sanctions pursuant to the statute and the four ways you can end up there. In fact, I spoke with someone at corrections for that very reason, and what they told me is that there is a intensive sanctions has a monitoring center in Madison that's located on Odana Road, and they contract with the counties, Dane County, for example, which is what happened in this case, to provide the actual monitoring services for people who are released on other programs. For example, in this case, he was released on the Dane County bail monitoring program, or he was subject
to
two conditions.
Is it any? Does it matter to them if the guy's there under DIS or he's there under the Dane County contract? Does the phone call come in on a different line? Do they apply different rules, or doesn't it make any difference?
I don't think it matters, but
I think that's
right,
the point.
Right. That's the point, is that it makes no difference, but the difference is he wasn't actually placed in intensive sanctions. But I'd like to also state that it's best to deal with this question of dis as it relates to sentence credit in a case that actually involves intensive sanctions, so that this question receives the full attention in the briefs and from the parties. And that's not what happened in this case.
Well,
and I am aware.
I asked you whether you'd overrule Colette for its ultimate holding, which was dis doesn't get set, does get sentence credit, or you'd overrule it for its concept of looking at each case on a case-by-case method to determine whether it's a functional equivalent of confinement.
Right.
What's your position?
That Colette is unworkable regardless, and it should just be gotten rid of. That's our primary position. We should go to the escape statute. It's workable. It has clearer standards. But I would note that in this case, even though this was not an intensive sanctions case, and it's my understanding in other cases as well, the Court of Appeals has not limited the Colette holding to intensive sanctions cases.
We have quite a number of cases we're holding.
Right.
On this sentence.
And some of them are intensive sanctions cases. That's why my only point is that it may be more appropriate to address the specifics of intensive sanctions in a case that is actually addressing that situation.
This whole question of credit has quite a history in this state. And at least the extent that the defendant's brief is correct, and I believe it is, I read a couple of the cases, it really has its foundation back in the 70s when this court was concerned about equal protection.
Right.
Now, my understanding of the facts of this case is that he couldn't afford the bond that was set, correct? And so there was a modification that allowed him to, the point being, if he had the money, if he was Ted Turner or somebody, he would have not been confined at all, correct?
That's true. He did receive credit for the time that he spent in custody while he was unable to
post. No, what I'm saying is, as I understand this, he was on the trial court set bail at $12,000 per count, and he couldn't meet that. And so that was reduced to a 10,000 signature bond, but with conditions.
Right, but he was still released from jail. Right.
But if he had the money, if he had $96,000, he would not have been confined at all, correct?
True, but our point is that also that he wasn't confined at all once he was released.
Yeah, but my point is that aren't there some significant equal protection problems there?
I don't think so. He got credit for all the time he spent in jail while he was unable
to post
bond.
The issue of the case, though. The issue of the case is, do you consider the electronic monitoring jail? Then the question is, being treated equally as someone who had the money, it wouldn't have to be.
Because he was deprived of his freedom of movement. There's no question about that, right?
We dispute that, actually. He had
liberty to move. Well, he couldn't go more than 75 feet away from his monitoring device. Whereas if a fellow had sufficient money, he could go 150 miles from his, because there would be no monitoring device.
Well, the purposes of bail and bond, I mean, a person can be released without bail or bond, or can just be released on their own recognizance without conditions imposed if the court feels that that is appropriate. In this particular case, for a variety of reasons, the court felt compelled to impose these certain conditions and keep control of him while he was released by placing these conditions on him. But confinement to his home or detention in his home is a far cry from being detained in the jail, which is what sentence credit.
Well, if you had your choice, would you rather be able to go to New York or not go to New York?
I've never been there, so it might be interesting.
You understand my point.
I do understand your point.
I mean, the old saw, iron bars and mortar do not a prison make.
Right, but even one confined to their home with electronic monitoring or not still enjoys a lot of liberties. They have freedom of association. They can have their friends come and go. They can have everything from the outside world essentially brought to them. And the point in this case that's very important, Mr. Magnuson for up to 16 hours a day, could go anywhere he wanted, do anything he wanted within Dane County. That is hardly the equivalent of being in the Dane County jail from which he was released.
The only point I'm making is he's being treated differently than somebody could afford to meet bail. And his freedom of movement is curtailed. That doesn't cause you any problem at all.
No, because I don't think his being released, subject to home detention and these other conditions, is the equivalent of being in the jail. So I don't see a problem with that.
Even if I agree with that, but I mean, he's still being treated differently, and he's still not being treated as he would have been treated had he had $96,000 in his wallet.
Well, I'm not prepared to fully address that because it hasn't been raised in this case, but I still don't see. Right. No, I understand.
Could they have said, well, it's $96,000 and put on the bracelet too?
Sure.
And say you can't see the certain number of people.
To my understanding, they could have. You're right. They said he could not have contact with certain witnesses or victims. Excuse me. In this case. So I believe that under Chapter 969, the bail and bond statute, even if someone, I have to look more closely, but it's my understanding, and I could be incorrect, but it's my understanding that even if he's able to post this $96,000, they can impose restrictions on him. So, right.
What if the sentence is to home detention, electronic monitoring?
If the sentence is to home detention, electronic monitoring.
Not the Division of Intensive Sanctions, but, I mean, there are programs around the state where the sentence can be, 6 months on the bracelet.
I'm still not willing to say that constitutes confinement either, because it's still not in an institution, But
counsel, if you escape from that, you're subject to an escape charge.
It's true. It's a closer question, but I still think there is this difference between pretrial release on bail or bond and being sentenced to a particular place.
Well, that's where that distinction becomes important, because otherwise you would never get, if you didn't get sentence credit for a sentence to home detention, you would never serve your sentence.
Right. So I think there is that difference, and that difference is made is by virtue of the fact that it is a sentence at that point, and there are differences. Being released prior to trial on conditions of bond is not, under the federal statute from which ours came, is not considered a situation that's in custody for purposes of sentence credit. I would just like to turn to make a few additional points. I see my time is running out, but our argument here is we're asking this court to return to the escape statute definition of custody, as was used by this court for years until the Collect case came along and altered the analysis to look at case by case, restriction by restriction, and even regardless of which test this court uses, but we're asking to return to the escape statute because it's more workable. It's a brighter line. It's clearer for sentencing courts to apply. Mr. Magnuson was not in custody.
May I suggest that the escape statute, because of the words without limitation, it just leaves a gaping hole. It's not clear. It's not precise. It's not easy at all. It says, I'm just arguing this. Custody includes without limitation. Then it lists a number of institutional kinds of confinement. But as soon as you put the words without limitation, there goes any bright line.
Well,
yes?
Courts have read that without limitation basically out of the statute. I mean, they basically said custody for purposes of escape means...
You mean they've been legislating? I mean, they've been...
Well, it may be that there hasn't been a situation where a court has felt compelled to look beyond that. And so at this point, courts have not gone beyond the actual custody or the constructive custody defined in the statute. And it's unclear as to you know, what kind of situation maybe would require a court to go beyond that language. But I think the escape statute with just those two definitions is clear and provides for the types of things that really would be considered custody under the federal statute, which is really what our legislature intended.
The SM34A says, not included within the definition of custody is home detention. They put that in with a cite to State v. Harris. But they have also all situations, this is not included within custody, all situations where the offender's status is such that his leaving the most restrictive part of that status without permission would not result in criminal liability for escape. So the positive part of that is, if it does result in criminal liability for escape, it should come within the definition of custody.
Right, and home detention pursuant.
So you disagree with that? I'm looking at...
Right, I see where you are, page six.
Right. Number three.
They're saying that those things that would not be custody, situations where you can't be charged with escape, are not custody.
That's right. This is a situation where you can be charged with escape.
Mr. Magnuson, to my understanding, could not be charged with escape. He could be charged with bail jumping.
All right, but if it was DIS, he could be charged with escape.
Right.
Okay.
Right. All right.
That gets me back to my initial proffering of a test. How about that custody is defined as being placed in any location where the absconding from that location would subject you to a criminal charge of escape?
That would certainly help make the Colette test more workable and create a brighter line. And if this court could add some language to the Colette functional equivalent of confinement to give some sentencing courts guidance as to what exactly that means, that would certainly help the test. But we still think that the escape statute definition is preferable. It covers more situations or makes it clear which situations are covered.
And you still don't like that if he absconds from DIS, that that if it was a DIS sentence that or confinement, that it would be sentence credit. You don't approve of that.
I think it remains to be decided, I think, exactly how this plays out in an intensive sanctions context, because the statute would suggest that maybe people in intensive sanctions are supposed to get sentence credit by virtue of being defined as a prison and as an institution, but I don't know for sure if that was what the legislature intended in the context of intensive sanctions.
Thank you, Ms. Herman.
Thank you.
Herman, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Finley, representing the defendant, Paul Magnuson.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Sentence credit in Wisconsin is premised on a fundamental concern for fairness and for consistency. Justice Babich, as you've suggested, it has its origins in the decisions of this court in the 1970s dealing with equal protection principles. So we know that its origins have to do with fairness in a constitutional equal protection sense. But when the legislature adopted 973.155 in 1977, the legislature went even further. And it addressed that concern for fairness and consistency. But it also addressed fairness and consistency in another sense. The statute, I believe, addresses fairness and consistency in the sense that it evinces concern and the notion that an individual should receive credit for all time spent in custody prior to sentencing, which would count as service of the sentence after sentencing. That is to say, the statute, I believe, fairly read, is premised on the notion that any type of restraint that would satisfy the sentence ought to count toward the sentence, regardless of when that time is served.
Okay.
interrupting. I noticed so it's a matter of degree, and you're saying that in this case it was restrictive enough. What if this person was put on probation, say you're talking about after sentence, and it was simply he's on probation for 3 years and has to maintain work and reside in Dane County? Are you suggesting that that would also be considered as in custody?
No, I'm not suggesting.
So I'm just saying that this, your argument, as I understand it, is you're saying that it's restrictive enough in this case to be in custody. So I'm looking, well, do I subtract out, well, urine samples? Do I subtract out daily monitoring? Do I subtract out electric, being on the bracelet? At what level is it not custody?
In response to your question about probation, the escape statute itself deals with that and says that you're not liable for an escape charge if you're on probation or parole unless you're in actual custody. So that deals with that in itself. But what I'm suggesting is actually going a little bit further and not... If there's one area that I've come to agree with the state on, and it is this, and that is that I think that a bright-line rule probably is a good idea. But the bright line rule that I suggest you adopt is one that looks to the statutes as a whole to understand what is it that the legislature means when it talks about custody. And the bright line rule that leads me to is this. The bright line rule would be that an individual is entitled to custody, is in custody, entitled to credit, whenever the individual is placed on home detention with electronic monitoring. Okay? That's the bright line rule that I suggest.
Now, is that for 1 hour a day, 12, 10, or any electronic?
Well,
because here it was half.
Yeah, and that's a fair question. But I think in reality, the way it's going to work out in the real world is no court is going to put anyone on electronic monitoring except for a significant part of the day, at least 8 hours a day, because people sleep at least that long, and there's no point in putting someone on electronic monitoring for 20 minutes a day or 2 hours a day. It wouldn't serve any purpose.
Well,
so,
what about the defendant or the condition, for instance, that as a condition of this bail, you must appear at the jail every day at 5 o'clock just to check in? Now, that's a pretty significant deprivation, but your bright line wouldn't cover it.
No, it wouldn't. And the reason, but I think there's justification for that. And the reason I say that is that because, again, what I'd like to do is direct the court's attention to the entire statutory scheme, to look at what is it that the legislature means when it talks about custody. And we have several tools to tell us how to do that. One is 973.155 itself. Then we have the escape statute, but we also have several statutes that deal with home detention with electronic monitoring itself. And then we have what Gilbert did, is that we can also look to common usages of the term custody and dictionary definitions. But I have provided to the court for convenience,
no,
I hope
no,
it will
no,
end.
I'd like you to stay with me just a moment.
Yeah, I'm trying to. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
I just wanted to say I provided to the court a chart that lays out the other statutes that I think are relevant and sort of gives a picture of what the legislature is talking about when it talks about custody.
The point that I'm making, just to make it, I guess for my own benefit, is that there can be other forms of restrictions that accomplish the same result as electronic monitoring that don't actually require electronic monitoring. Every 6 hours appear here, every 2 hours appear there. How does that cover? I'm trying to...
Yeah, I understand. Right, I'm sorry, I'm being slow about it. I am trying to get to your to your point. Yes, there are things like that. I think, on balance, most of us would agree that that's not as restrictive, not as confining, as, say, telling someone they have to stay in one particular spot for 8, 12, 16 hours a day, whatever it may be. But more than that, we have statutes that help us understand what the legislature means when it talks about custody. We have the escape statute, and then we have all of these various home detention with electronic monitoring statutes. And if you look at them, 301.046, 301.048, 302.425, etc., they all talk about confinement in one's home or another designated area with electronic monitoring. And they all talk about that type of confinement as being a type of imprisonment, of the individuals in that type of custody as being prisoners, and of those individuals being subject to escape charges for violating. It seems to me that what is happening here is the legislature is telling us pretty clearly that at least when you're on home detention, when you're confined to one particular location for a significant portion of a day, and that is monitored with electronic high-tech monitoring devices, that at least that constitutes confinement, constitutes custody in the legislature's view.
It seems to me that if you look at these, there's only one exception, sentence to home confinement. The definition that Justice Bradley proposes would really cover you, which is I don't want to use the word confined, but if the court instructs a status from which there's disobedience, then the escape penalties apply. That's good enough.
That might work.
Doesn't work in one sentence to home confinement.
But I think it actually works there as well. And the reason I think that is because I think Justice Bradley is also correct that the escape statute itself is no bright line rule. That's why I think the state's rule, the proposed rule the state has, doesn't solve the problem. It isn't a bright line rule. But what I think, the reason that I think that proposal you've made may work nonetheless is because I think that under the escape statute, someone sentenced to DIS who departs surely can be charged with escape. I find it hard to believe that the legislature actually created a sentencing disposition confining an individual to a location, monitoring the individual in that location, and provided no means of enforcing that sentence.
Counsel, and this chart I find very helpful, but I note, as the Chief indicated, that in the chart, start with the community residential confinement, and that indicates that there is an escape charge for failure of a prisoner to remain within the limits of their confinement or return within the time prescribed by the superintendent. Intensive sanctions gives an escape charge. The same kind of thing. Same language, but it has the escape charge, as you note. The home detention program, which sounds, I suppose, a lot like sentence to home confinement, but it's different. I think it's different because the sheriff has to do the placement. Is that correct?
The statute provides that the sheriff places, and it can be done pre-trial, post-trial, whatever.
And there's a specific statute that says escape, that provides for escape in home confinement. The problem is, for your client, in this chart, it's the only one that doesn't have a specific statute that allows for an escape charge. So my rule doesn't cover your client.
Well, your rule covers the client if you read the escape statute to cover my client.
But in all of the other ones, 301.046, the escapes is sub 6 of that. For intensive sanctions, 301.048, the escape is sub 5 of that. For home detention in 302.425, escape is sub 6 of that. There's nothing with regard to 973.034A where your client.
And that, it seems to me, the absence of that provision, I think, cannot be read to mean that an escape charge cannot lie. If you look at what 973.03 does, it allows for actual imposition of a sentence to that type of confinement. It's hard to imagine, and I'm not sure why the state would even want to argue that you can't charge someone with escape for violating the actual confinement ordered as a sentence. But not only that, there's an interesting, if you look at the timing of how all this happened, I think there's an interesting possible explanation here. The state suggests that that you can only look at the escape statute because it does. There's no reference made to any of these home detention statutes. Well, in State versus Gilbert and State versus Cobb and whatnot, 973-155 was adopted in 1977. Gilbert was decided in 1983. Cobb was decided in 1986. There had not yet been any ruling from any court about home detention. 1987 is when that statute that you're referring to, 973-03-4, was decided. 973-03-4 was enacted in that year. At that point, I think the legislature had no reason to ever believe that there was any possibility that someone sentenced to home confinement couldn't be charged with escape for taking off. It was then after that, in 1989, that the Court of Appeals in State versus Pettis, for the first time, suggested that home confinement doesn't count under the escape statute. And then after that, we get all these other statutes enacted in 1989 and 1991. And at that point, the legislature is put on notice. We better make sure that they understand that home confinement is an escape punishable status. So maybe it could be understood in that sense. But whatever it may be, I just simply don't believe that the silence in 973-03-4A can be read to mean that you can't be charged with escape. What that requires us to do instead is look at the escape statute itself. If we're going to follow your model, let's look at the escape statute itself and find out what does that statute say about whether one can be punished for escape, for leaving home detention. As you've suggested, the escape statute is not a bright line statute. It is very vague. It is very broad because it does provide, as you've suggested, custody includes without limitation, and then it mentions various types of actual confinement and then other types of constructive confinement. Contrary to Ms. Herman's statement earlier, the fact is the courts have not read that expansive language out of the statute. The courts have on several occasions noted that language exists and that the subsets of actual custody and constructive custody are indeed just that, subsets of custody under the escape statute, and do not define the entire scope of the custody statute. And Collette was a case that did that. Collette was all about interpreting the escape statute, and it noted that. But in addition to that, we have cases such as State versus Hoffman, State versus Scott. These are all cited in my brief. These are cases in which individuals were not in anyone's actual control. They weren't in an institution. And the Court of Appeals in those cases said, it doesn't matter. You don't have to be in actual custody. You don't have to be in actual physical restraint under the escape statute. Instead, what you have to have, as Scott says, for instance, says, in custody means a person's ability or freedom of movement has been restricted. A person could be in custody within the meaning of the escape statute without proof of physical control.
What's your citation there?
That's 191 with second 146 at page 151.
Counsel, your bright line rule, which is electronic monitoring policy.
Yeah.
Solves this case. Now, next month, another person has got a condition. He set bail at $10,000 or $50,000. He can't meet it. So then the judge says, okay, I'll reduce that bail to $10,000 on condition that you not leave Dane County. And then they come to see you. Now, what kind of challenges do you don't? Isn't there potential equal protection challenges there? And very much the same arguments that are made can be made with him?
Seems to me, no, that there aren't. I think, by the way, you are correct. There is an equal protection challenge in this case, which I regret to say hasn't been developed in the briefs, but I think you're absolutely right about that. But in this hypothetical that you've posed, I don't think there is that same type of challenge, because there's really no argument to be made that that person was in custody. Their freedom of movement in a big, broad sense was regulated to some degree.
Well, a wealthy man can go to New York. Guy who can't come up with $50,000 cash.
Yes, but the question is, for sentence credit purposes, is was this person nonetheless in custody? Now, maybe there's some other remedy that could be provided for this person, but I just don't think by any stretch anyone would say that that person is in custody. And again, I would refer the court back to the statutory provisions we have. The home detention statutes, the escape statutes, none of them would arguably cover that situation. They all would, in fact, cover Mr. Magnuson's situation. And that's where I draw the line there.
I guess my hypothetical doesn't refer to the statute, because I recognize the words in custody.
Right.
I think any good lawyer would bring an equal protection challenge.
But they'd have a hard time getting sentence credit for it, because those words in custody aren't there.
Let me follow up on Justice Babbage's comments and hypothetical. I recall that on occasion with a couple of my favorite defendants, I would say, I want to see you every day at my office at 1 o'clock to monitor them. I didn't have electronic monitoring, and I submit that that may have been more restrictive than letting them be on some kind of electronic monitoring for only a segment of the day. What about that?
If we're going to draw a line, and we have to, it's got to be drawn somewhere. And it seems to me it makes most sense to draw it in a bright line way, and to draw it at confinement in a particular place with electronic monitoring, because the statutes tell us that, and because it makes sense. That person is truly confined. The person who has to come in and check in with you is not confined. They have a duty to perform once a day, but they're not confined. They're not in custody. I think the real problem is with the state's bright line rule and with the possibilities that might come up. It seems to me the state's bright line rule is already antiquated. It's based on notions of imprisonment and jail that are already passed. We've already gone beyond them. And if you adopt the state's bright line rule, which is basically look to the escape statute, and under the way we interpret the escape statute, you don't get credit for home detention, period. Well, that's not going to solve the problem for very long. What happens if in the next case, instead of being confined to the pastor's home, the defendant is confined to the sheriff's home or to the probation office? Or to a group home.
Or to the judge's office.
Not my home.
or Ms. Herman says people on home confinement have freedom of association. They can see whoever they want. Well, what if in the next case the court says you're confined to your home on electronic monitoring and no one may enter your home, and we're going to put video cameras in all the rooms in your house, and no one, and if someone comes in, we'll know that's happened and you're in trouble. You're going back to jail. Surely, even under the state's bright line rules, somebody's going to come in and make a very strong challenge to that. What if the state creates a building out in the community? They call it an apartment building, and in it they put apartments, but they look just like a cell at Waupun or even at Boscobel. There's no locks on the doors and no guards there, but there's electronic monitoring, and you're not allowed to leave that place. Under the state's rule, you get no credit. But you know that's going to be challenged, and it's going to be a good challenge, because what's happened is the state has not allowed for the possibility that notions of custody will change. And how will they change? They will change by the state creating ever more effective means of restraining and monitoring people in the community outside the prison walls.
Well, the thing that I'm questioning is, let me accept your argument that the escape statute is not a good enough bright line rule. But I don't understand your bright line rule. Your bright line rule says electronic monitoring counts. Well, it doesn't cover all the other situations.
What other situations? I'm sorry.
Well, it doesn't cover necessarily the community residential confinement. That doesn't have it. That has electronic monitoring?
Yes, all of these programs require electronic monitoring.
What about the jail inmate who contracts TB in the jail and has to be quarantined outside of the jail? Just happened in Milwaukee.
Well, that person would be under the escape statute, would be in constructive custody because they would be temporarily released from the jail for a specified purpose. So that would be covered under the escape statute as well.
That's
a different provision.
So you want both the state's rule and your rules?
Well, no, I think if an escape charge would lie, surely you get credit. But what I'm talking about is whether an escape charge would lie or not. If you're on home detention with electronic, and I think it would, by the way, an escape charge would lie, but if my rule is if you're on home detention with electronic monitoring, you do get the credit.
Okay, so you want both, essentially.
Well, there's parts of that that's a separate question, but yes, I think that would still continue to apply, as it always has. I mean, State versus Sevelin, a court of appeals case, is that case, essentially. I mean, the defendant was not released because of TB, but he was released for treatment, and the court of appeals held under the escape statute, that's constructive custody. You get credit. I'm not talking about changing that in any respect.
That was the point.
I'm not changing that at all. Instead, what I'm saying is when you don't have that, but you do have home detention with electronic monitoring, you get the credit. Because we know that in this state, a home detention with electronic monitoring is a type of imprisonment. It is a type of custody.
So a bright line plus the mushy rule that's hard to apply. We should keep both of them, basically, as a fallback position.
Well, I mean, yes, that is a fallback position. I think that's a separate case, and that's a separate set of principles at work that don't really directly apply to this situation necessarily. I'm not talking about taking that away. That's correct.
What about a bright line rule that says any condition that deprives an individual of freedom of his or her freedom of movement helps us more credit?
That would work with me.
Gotcha.
I'm perfectly happy with that rule. I think it's a little harder to justify under the statutory scheme, but I think there'd be fine justification in the sense, in the fairness sense, that if your freedom of movement is restricted, yes. But
well,
I'm trying
doesn't
to.
Doesn't every personal recognizance bond say that the defendant can't leave the jurisdiction?
Well, yes, and that's a problem with that rule. Which is why that's not the rule I'm proposing.
Even though it would be okay with you.
It's okay with me, but it's not what I'm proposing.
Mr. Finley, why don't we go to the federal approach that was discussed earlier? What's wrong with saying no credit when released on bond? That we're not going to bother worrying about the condition?
You're not
in custody and there's no credit. You've been released on bond. That per se means that you are not in custody.
I understand that proposition. The problem with that is that rule in the federal system is based on a different set of statutes than we have in Wisconsin and is based on a different set of bail provisions than we have here. Under the federal system, you only get credit. I mean, I'm sorry, you're only considered in custody if you're actually within the custody of the Bureau of Prisons or the Attorney General. And so anytime you're released on bail, you're not in custody any longer. That's not how it works in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, it is established that one may receive credit for time on bail. For instance, what if court releases someone on bail but requires that the person spend their nights in the Huber facility? Clearly you get credit for that. The state's argument proves too much because it would deny that jailed individual credit for that time. State versus Sevelin is a case in which an individual was released on bail to a treatment facility and the Court of Appeals granted credit. The jury instructions, SM34A, recognize that there may be custody even when someone is released on bail, and the jury instructions expressly provide for credit in that situation. I'm looking at page 5 of SM34A, where the SM34A provides the following situations would be within this definition of custody. One, detention in the county jail before bail is set or thereafter, so it's a bail situation. Two, detention in the county jail during non-working hours as a condition of bail. The federal rule works fine in the federal system, but it's not Wisconsin's system. Those cases are simply inapplicable here. The federal system, by the way, also doesn't have all of these statutory provisions for home detention that treats home detention as a type of custody that we have. So it seems to me the federal system just does not translate well.
Counsel,
What if here your client had to be electronically monitored during his curfew hours, is that correct?
That's right.
The rest of the time he was free to roam, is that correct?
Within Dane County, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What if I had a young fellow who's 18 and he was still in high school, so I didn't have him electronically monitored then, and his parents worked and came home about 5:30 every day. So I didn't need electronically monitoring them. They told me in court, we'll take care of Bobby and make sure he's at home. It's only those after-school hours, 3:30 to 5:30. I want to make sure he's where he's supposed to be. And he would get credit, sentence credit, for being 2 hours a day electronic monitoring.
No, I think the rule I'm proposing would be one that says, it has to be, if you look at the language in the cases and in the SM-34, it talks about confinement for a significant portion of the day, the functional equivalent of being locked in at night.
That's obviously what I'm getting to now.
Right.
So so tell me, what's good enough? 6 hours? 8 hours? 7.5 hours? 7.5 hours with someone you don't like as opposed to 9 hours playing Nintendo? I mean,
if you want to pick a time, I would propose at least 8 hours because that's a typical night. If the court says, in the hypothetical you've posited, if the court says, well, I only need the electronic monitoring for 2 hours a day, if the court's going to put the kid on electronic monitoring for 2 hours a day, it seems to me that realistically the court's just going to say, well, we've got it up and running, may as well monitor him for the rest of the time that I'm ordering that he actually remain home. If not, my rule would say he doesn't get the credit. But the court would be aware of that. The court would know that before imposing it. Everyone would know that, and the defendant, the kid, would know that before deciding whether to accept that type of monitoring. Because one of the key things about all of these home detention programs is the defendant doesn't have to accept it. And if you don't give him credit, you're creating a pretty good incentive not to accept it, and you're sort of undermining the utility of this type of program, which I think is going to become increasingly important as we move into times of higher overcrowding. And whatnot.
Suppose the family says, I'll get a security guard that's going to take care of him from me of his own apartment. Instead of electronic monitoring, we'll get a guard that's going to assure that he's going to be there.
Maybe I should modify my rule in this way. Home detention with actual monitoring, whether it be in person or by high-tech means,
well,
electronic.
That's why I asked you that
the
question.
Functional equivalent.
It's the same thing.
What about day reporting centers then?
I'm sorry?
Day reporting centers.
I'm not sure what you're referring to. I'm sorry.
It's a new thing. Corrections. Where the defendant has to report in during the day as opposed to at night and be at the day reporting center during the daylight hours participating in treatments, educational programs, counseling, etc. So it may be in excess of 8 hours a day that they have to be there, and it's not a locked facility, but if you know there are people there guarding them and watching them, then they go to their own homes at night. And that's a form of pretrial release.
I suppose under my rule that would be a type of monitoring. This is obviously something I've not contemplated because I wasn't familiar with it.
We're thinking about it. So you're knocking out a guard dog too, right? Person or electronic.
Well,
I'm just being a little facetious, but I'm just pointing out that when we get into this, and that was the point.
I think it has to be
that was the point of my question about 20 minutes ago, was as you talk about restrictions and restrictive, and you go down this list, I think it's what you're proposing, at least I can see, is some type of bright line.
Seems to me you have to stay if you're going to do a bright line, it has to be with electronic monitoring, because then you get into gradations of monitoring from the dog to the security guard to the day reporting
to the mother.
And I have no problem with that. That's I'm sorry, what's the problem with getting into those gradations?
Well, look what Justice Bradley is pointing out. We go into a functional equivalent test, functional equivalent monitoring. We're going to have this before 70 days for the next 10 years. But let me ask you this, Chief Mayor. Do we get any help? As I think about custody, I think about the definition of custodial interrogation for purposes of Miranda. And I think custodial has custody is defined there, a deprivation of movement or the freedom of movement in any significant manner, something like that. Do we get any help at all from looking at those cases to determine what custody is?
Well, yeah, I think you do get some help there, especially if you're relying on the escape statute. Because the escape statute cases look to that very test to determine whether someone is in custody. And they hold that in situations where the police are trying to effectuate an arrest, for example. They look to whether the person meets that standard, whether their freedom of movement has been restricted in any way, whether a reasonable person would believe that they were not free to leave, that kind of question. And it's based on that analysis that some of the escape cases hold that someone who's not in any kind of physical restraint can still be charged with escape for taking off and running. So especially if we're going to rely on the escape statute, yes, I think that's an important issue and can be very helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Finley.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Herman.
So I'd like to use this 5 minutes to clarify a few things that Mr. Finley touched on. First of all, with respect to his chart, which lists different statutes that talk about home detention as he's characterizing these statutes, I think it's very important to note that Mr. Magnuson is not subject to any of these statutes on this chart. He's not sentenced to home confinement. He's not in community residential confinement or intensive sanctions or home detention where the sheriff moved him out of the jail. So these statutes are really irrelevant to Mr. Magnuson's situation because these are all situations that do not apply, and the majority of them are sentencing options. And as I explained before, release on bail, someone is in an entirely different status and it serves entirely different purposes than someone who's been convicted and sentenced, who under those circumstances, part of the purpose of them being placed in one place or another is rehabilitative or punitive. When someone is released on bond or bail with certain conditions, the main purpose is to assure their appearance at trial. So it's an entirely different situation, and I don't think that these statutes are very relevant to this case here. Turning to Mr. Finley's proposed bright-line rule of an individual is in custody whenever on home detention with electronic monitoring as modified by Justice Babbage or the functional equivalent of some sort of electronic monitoring. We strongly disagree with that, particularly the electronic monitoring or the functional equivalent component of that, because electronic monitoring makes no difference with respect to the question of custody. Someone subject to electronic monitoring or a guard or a dog or whatever else we can think of, if they're confined to their home or detained to their home, still enjoys lots of liberties within their home. They can play Nintendo. They can have, they can eat what they want. They can do what they want. They can basically engage in any activity within the home, and they have unrestricted freedom of movement within whatever their radius is, whether it's 75 feet of the electronic monitoring device in this case, which, by the way, is a significant area within which Mr. Magnuson was allowed. I mean, that would have allowed, considering the average size house and yard, he probably could have gone to the neighbor's house and still been within 75 feet of that electronic monitoring device. So things like electronic monitoring or making face-to-face daily contact are merely detection devices to make sure the person is complying with the other restrictions imposed on them. It is not something that actually restricts a person's movement within the home or actually confines them to the home in any way, particularly electronic monitoring. Because, as I said earlier, a person can still physically walk away from the home. The electronic monitoring bracelet does not somehow chain them to the home in any way. It's a way of detecting if they choose to violate the condition that they remain in the home. I would also like to talk about getting back to the equal protection problem here. I believe there was a question about, well, isn't there an equal protection problem? A wealthy man can go to New York or something to that effect. But I think it needs to be remembered that even a wealthy man who can post the $96,000 in this case can still have conditions imposed upon that person. Even though they can pay the money, they're still potentially subject to the exact same restrictions that Mr. Magnuson was subject to. He was released on his own recognizance, so he didn't actually have to pay that money. But someone else who has the money to post still may be subject to the same restrictions. So there really isn't an equal protection problem. And also, the freedom of movement being the equivalent of custody is really too broad of a rule, particularly when we're talking about home detention, because as I just explained, home detention really is not the functional equivalent of confinement when the person still has all the same, can still engage in all the same activities within the home that they would have otherwise had they not been subject to being in the home during certain hours. While in that home, they can still enjoy liberties that you just cannot possibly enjoy in a jail setting. If there are no further questions, then we respectfully ask this court to overturn the Court of Appeals decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Justice Crasser.
Could you explain to me how the electronic monitoring worked? Was it put on every time he went to the pastor's house, or was he wearing it all the time?
It's my understanding, and Mr. Finley might know specifically the details. I just know what's in the record, and my understanding of electronic monitoring. He wore a bracelet, I think it might have been on his ankle. And it's my understanding there was some electronic monitoring device in the home. I'm not sure where it was placed. I don't know if it was on the telephone. Some sort of device that actually transmits a signal. So during that curfew hours where Mr. Magnuson was supposed to be in the home during the overnight hours, essentially, the monitoring device that came from would send a signal, and it would come from this monitoring center over on Odana Road that I was talking about earlier, would send a signal every 16 seconds or something. And all it does is, assuming Mr. Magnuson is there and within the 75 feet, basically, you know, it monitors that he's there. If he's not within the 75 feet or he's gone or whatever, then somehow it sends a signal. There's no signal probably coming back from Mr. Magnuson's bracelet, so they know he's in violation of that condition, that he'd be within the home and be within 75 feet.
Did he actually wear the bracelet 24 hours a day?
I believe he wears this thing all the time. It's only activated as far as the signal being sent during the times that he was required to remain in the home, which would have been the overnight hours. That's my understanding of how it works.
So manacles with an invisible chain.
I guess. I'm not sure. And I think there are quite a variety of kinds of electronic monitoring, too, that I think there are things that wands that someone can wave if someone's supposed to be working at their place of employment, they can drive by and basically know that person is there.
Does the character of the device change post-conviction?
I don't know. I think it can be the same type of bracelet and the same type of monitoring.
It's the same. Device.
Right, that's my understanding.
Thank you again. And the court is adjourned for January. Sitting.